This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome aboard, friends. Before we get started, let's once again welcome KBURAM 1490 in Burlington, Iowa. It's actually, I believe the market is referred to as Quad Cities. But I don't know. How do you say hello to Quad Cities? So I thought I would just sort of pick one and say, Burlington, how are you? Burlington, Iowa. KBURAM 1490. We said hello to them last week, but I believe this is the week they're actually signing on to the broadcast. So always a delight to welcome new affiliates to the program and welcome all of you individually as well. I hope you're safe and warm. You can just smell autumn in the air, right? As about 4 o'clock today, as a matter of fact, 4 p.m. Eastern. Won't be long before the frost is on the pumpkin, as they say. Hey, of course, everyone is still abuzz about this horrible shooting in the Washington Navy Yard that happened last week, claiming 12 people. But here's an interesting email that's going around that I received, courtesy of our good friend Nelson Thal, who joins us here in the program from time to time. I just thought I would share this with you in the early going before we get kick-started here. So, you know when a shooting is government-staged when the shooter is former military, the shooter is a mental health patient of the military, the shooter was taking psychiatric medication, the shooter has top-secret clearance, there are multiple unknown shooters. How many times have we heard that? Not only in this case, but in many, many cases. We hear the initial reports, more than one shooter, and then we don't hear about it again. There are multiple unknown shooters. Only one shooter is caught and blamed. The shooter could not have succeeded without help. The shooter is killed before he can be questioned. The shooting is at a contained government facility. The government is running active shooter drills. Sound familiar? The media jumps all over the story at once. The politicians have legislation ready to pass instantly. The guns involved are exactly what the administration or the legislators want to ban. And then it says, updated, add your own in the replies. And the list is growing, I guess, as this email goes round and round. Thank you for that, Nelson Thal. Many of those things do sound eerily familiar, like, yes, I've seen this movie before and I know how it ends. Well, that's a particularly tragic example, of course. But many of us are, in fact, beginning to sense that there is something terribly wrong with this picture. You may call it high strangeness, if you will. And in fact, I just want to crib here from a new book out called On the Edge of Reality, and the co-authors are standing by to join me, Colin and Cynthia Andrews, in just a moment. But I just found this very, very interesting. And they're talking about instances or opinions, I guess, on paranormal phenomena. and how they are on the rise. And they use as the example, it was a poll taken about how many people believe in life after death. Now, of course, while I'm talking about it, I've lost the page. But it's in the last 40 years, the number of people, for example, who believe in life after death has just grown by leaps and bounds. Now, what is that all about? I think it's something like on the order of 72%. I'm guessing this was a poll conducted in the United States. 70% of people now believe in life after death, whereas I don't know what the numbers were 40 years ago, but considerably less. Now, what is that all about? Is that more and more people are now beginning to experience these things? Same thing if you look at the belief in extraterrestrial life or UFOs, growing by leaps and bounds. Other paranormal activity, ghosts and so forth. One has to ask, what is at the root of this? And so, here to help us answer that question are Colin Andrews, a visionary and 30-year veteran investigator of unusual phenomena. He's best known for his work with crop circles. In fact, he termed the coin back in 1983. We will get around to talking about crop circles. Colin is also responsible for discovering the correlation between patterns of radar interference and weather conditions in Australia, where weather modification projects are underway. He's currently involved in investigating consciousness and non-ordinary reality. Non-ordinary reality. I love that. He's the author of 8 books, and he is, as I say, co-author of On the Edge of Reality. Colin Andrews, welcome aboard, sir. How are you?
I'm very fine, thank you, Richard. Thanks for having Cynthia and I on your show.
All right, and now we're going to say hello to, may I call her your better half?
Of course.
Cynthia Andrews.
My much better half.
Well, as I always say, you know, people meet the mighty Aphrodite. I say, yes, I know, I married well above my station. I'm not saying that about you, Colin. I'm not saying that about you. Cynthia Andrews is a naturopathic physician, energy intuitive, and author of 5 books, including The Path of Energy and The Path of Emotions. Cynthia, welcome to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Richard. I'm looking forward to the talk.
Well, we are going to talk about high strangeness, but we're also going to talk about, as much as we can get to. I mean, this is, always the challenge. What can you get done in 50 minutes or so? But we'll hopefully touch on hidden technology, powers of the mind, quantum physics, a paranormal phenomena, of course, orbs, UFOs, harmonic transmissions, and crop circles. I mean, that's you really bit off a lot here in this book. I mean, what led you, I guess, along this path and that resulted in this book? I'll throw that out to either of you.
Well, maybe I'll just pick that one up, Richard. The unusual began for me as an electrical engineer, which is what I am by profession. I was a senior official in the British regional government in 1983 when I actually kind of just took a casual glance out of my motor car on high ground and saw 5 perfect circles in a cereal crop. That's really when my life changed, literally. This book has come out of very detailed, long detailed years' worth of research into those crop circles, which, as you rightly say, it was a term that I coined in the early 80s. But, you know, as an engineer and working with other scientists and engineers, Dr. Terence Meaden, and Pat Delgado, a retired NASA engineer at the time and a light aircraft pilot, Busty Taylor, we were gathering data. That's how it all began, looking at the unusual, hearing the unusual on occasions. And what was totally bizarre was the strong impression that something else was very aware of what we were doing. We would have conversations, which we thought were private, between us, and points that we would make with regard to what it was we had discovered in the fields would then manifest quite the opposite, as if it was kind of playing back to us that we weren't just that clever and that they still had, or something, had some surprises up its sleeve. And, you know, this became more and more bizarre, totally bizarre, when Busty Taylor was the light aircraft pilot flying his aircraft over southern England, very close to Stonehenge on this particular occasion, turned to me as his passenger and said, you know, wouldn't it be really quite something to see all of the circles we've seen to date appear as one intricate design. And they were all relatively simple, but they were, you know, they were circles, straight three in a straight line, five forming a cross, and concentric rings and so on, all relatively simple compared to what we see today. And there below the aircraft, not anywhere else, but below the aircraft, never as it appeared on the planet before, directly under the aircraft the next day, was exactly that. And so, you know, the research widened out a little while after to encompass other subjects, because it was very clear that this had there was a very wide gambit of activity involved in the crop circle phenomena. So the book had to be written at some point, and it's now 30 years, three decades down the road from that casual glance which started the research, meeting Cynthia and her work, coming on board, and you know, it was a different side to the same coin, is really what it turned out, it seems to have turned out to be. So that's why the book was written, because we just had to, we felt, put this whole thing out there as we had discovered it to be.
Cynthia, let me throw this out to you, because I began sort of the preamble of this discussion, cribbing from your book, On the Edge of Reality, talking about high strangeness on the rise, and I talk about the 2002 poll conducted by the National Opinion Researcher at the University of Chicago, and the life after death question. 72% of those polled believe in it, and I'm just wondering, what do you think is behind? And I've seen other polls on other paranormal phenomena, and again, this is on the rise. This belief. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I think you hit it exactly on the head when you said it before. More and more people are having experiences, and it's because people are having experiences that minds are being opened and new things are happening. And I see this in the field of natural medicine all the time, and in you know, non-traditional medicine all the time, is that doctors will be adamantly opposed to what we're doing, but their wives are in seeing us every day, and their wives are having experiences, or husbands or spouses or whatever are having the experiences, and then taking it home, and then slowly doctor opinion begins to change and incorporate and integrate and become more open. And we're seeing the same thing in paranormal phenomenon. People are having experiences. The phone rings and you know who's on the other end. You're walking down the street thinking of a friend that you haven't seen in 20 years, and you turn the corner and there they are. And more and more and more people are having this as common everyday event. And so they begin to look beyond the conventions of social conventions that we have believed in all this time. And so I think you hit it exactly on the head.
I guess my question then would be, why is this happening now? These phenomena have been out there forever. Why now are we becoming in tune to them? Is there a rewiring in our brains going on, or is our global consciousness being elevated? Let me just throw that out there, and when we come back, I'll get you to tackle that one. Colin and Cynthia Andrews on the line as we discuss their new book, On the Edge of Reality, Hidden Technology, Powers of the Mind, Quantum Physics, Paranormal Phenomena, UFOs, Orbs, Harmonic Transmissions, and, of course, Crop Circles. Stay with us. Very nice comment on the back of On the Edge of Reality from the late Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., who just recently passed. On the Edge of Reality makes us as humans aware of a new reality that is going to guide our understanding of our place in the universe, and that we are all one, including the extraterrestrials who have been observing us for thousands of years. Quantum physics is slowly opening the door to mysteries of the universe and our place in it. It shows that the universe is more mysterious than we imagined, and indeed more mysterious than we can imagine. Colin and Cynthia Andrews, my guests, as we discuss high strangeness and, many aspects of paranormal phenomena. And I before the break, I was asking both of you, what's going on? Why are we perceiving a paranormal phenomena at a much greater degree? Is it something to do with the wiring in our brain? Is it to do with the electromagnetic activity in the around the globe? What's at the root of all this?
I think both of those things are involved in it, but I think the real issue going on right now is that we're going through a bottleneck in society, on the planet. All of the social structures that we look to are in one way or another collapsing, whether it's economic structures or religious or political structures. And, in fact, our environmental foundation is really in collapse at this time. And the old ways of doing things, the old ways of seeing the world and thinking aren't working anymore. And so we're being forced, we're being pushed through and forced to change our worldview, to change how we see ourselves in the world, to have this paradigm shift. And in doing that, we're opening up levels of perception that have always been there. They're just not been used in a long time. And as you say, these events have always been there. We just haven't been paying attention to them. We've been suffering inattentional blindness, where we only see the things that we're conditioned to see. But the rest of it has been there, and the conditions are really forcing us to open our eyes and pay attention more.
Inattentional blindness. Yeah, Colin, can you expand on that a little bit? Because you talk about inattentional blindness in the book. And how does that work exactly?
Well, it really is, seeing something that the subconscious actually does react in some fashion to an item or an event that we're not deeply structured with any kind of evolved sense to acknowledge it or to see it in our conscious minds. It's like looking through a person, a family member who's right in front of you, in a crowded room, in an unusual kind of environment. But if I might just say, Richard, that on the back end of what Cynthia was saying there, I think acknowledging, as most people do now in the sciences and the study of human behavior, that we are involved because we have to be in a paradigm shift. As Cynthia was saying, we are clearly at a crossroads here. There are only so many moves on the chessboard, and I think we've played most of them. We're at a very critical point where, if we intend to stay with nature's journey, we have to make our minds up who we want to be. The paradigm shift that is underway. We tend to talk about paradigm shifts and the tendency to look at scientific and technological trends that usher in new thinking. And a great deal of what we're discovering, however, does not represent a change in science and technology. It represents a change in humans. New information, which engages the mind, engages the emotions, and, emotional shift is what pushes people to expand. Each person who has experienced a high strangeness event holds a small piece of a larger picture, and it's time, I think, to put those pieces together. It's not about what we can theorize or prove. It is about what we experience and how we feel. It's about the changes our experiences create within us and how that alters the way we see and interact with the world. We are at a turning point, and people's personal stories, I think, are more important than ever. It's all part of this transition that is underway, and what's playing out through the paranormal and high strangeness events, I think we can expect to see accelerate further because nature's systems are under such stress. Human and natural infrastructure is at a kind of crashing point. We see that in our climate. That's the natural one, which many think we've had a considerable hand in. A population is 7 billion, and that's kind of well beyond the threshold at which can be sustained. Political and religious strife is all around us this very evening as we speak, with you in Toronto. And the Earth changes solar activity. It's all there. It cannot be denied. We simply are, as we say, the book says, on the edge of reality.
Yeah, I think many of us have this sense, it's deep down in our gut, that something wicked this way comes, to quote Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
We can't necessarily put our finger on it, but we are in the midst of this terrible, some may call it you know, cataclysmic event that's coming our way, that's staring us in the face. Others, maybe, and this is what the Mayans perhaps were talking about, when there's a very painful birthing process. So, you know, how do we come out the other side? If this is a birthing process, let's go with that analogy, because I think there's a little more hope in that one than, you know, some cataclysmic event, a planet killer, if you will. What do we expect coming out the other side?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity to get to answer that by making a very brief statement here. I think that needs to be said. Cynthia and I co-authored also the For the Complete Idiot's Guide series of books, the 2012 book. We were not experts in the Mayan prophecy. We studied for some considerable months in research for writing the book, and what we certainly discovered was that the Mayan elders never ever did relate their prophecy as the end of the world, which of course we know, you know, the Hollywood movie did, and the media kind of jumped on it and made a lot of the fun of the Mayan elders themselves, you know, really discredited them greatly. But 2012, as seen through the scientists of their day, studying astrology and astronomy, happened. It happened and is still happening. You know, what the Mayan predicted at the end of that 25,000-year period was exactly what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, and it's continuing to happen. It was, you know, the end of a period of time, natural and man-made, and a transition to a newer period. And as you were, you know, saying there, now where do we come out the other side? Well, I personally think that the real nub of this is basically the mirror that is now being placed in front of every single human being. You know, what we're looking at here and have to look at is, as individuals, we've got to find a place. We've got to be able to somehow or other to get on the same page and to respect one another, dare I say, love one another. You know, as we struggle with the most, you would think, the most simple thing, to actually, you know, love one another, and it is this big, huge struggle to do so. But I think that really is, that's the nub of this, is we've got to come through the deception and the lies. The lies and deception, which is just a hallmark of government, it would seem, of politicians. You know, this has got to end, and we've got to find somewhere a place where we can provide hope for our children, and that does not come from the past period that we're leaving now, thank goodness.
Go ahead, Cynthia, sorry.
Well, just to tag on to that, I mean, really what we're entering into is a stage where we join our mind and emotions and use our intention in the most positive way possible, and understand that our intention has more force in the world than we realize.
Where do you think then that the UFO phenomena, crop circles, orbs, where do these fit in? What are we to make then, in light of what you just said about this, you know, expansion of global consciousness, or certainly the need for this evolution in global consciousness, this rocky, you know, road that we're heading on, that we're traveling along now. Where do UFOs and orbs and crop circles fit into all this?
I think what it's squeezing both of those subjects, what I think they are doing, and others also, they're really placing us through a fine filter. They're squeezing out of us those better elements, and they're also tasking us with developing, maturing the intuitive, the sixth sense, that you feel, as Cynthia was saying, that, you know, that you think of a person, the phone rings, you have a thought which feels unnatural to you, and some people will question it as being their own, and others will simply react to it. This is kind of where it gets a little bit more unusual. And starting with the crop circles, I think that's probably the place to go. That's where I started. Those interactions that I was referring to earlier, I'll give you a couple of very quick examples. You'll see exactly what where I'm coming from. This is a Tai Chi instructor now I'm referring to, who one day several years ago now decided with his younger brother to make a Flower of Life crop circle. His brother was ill this particular night, and they were unable to get out in the fields to manufacture it. But in the very field that they had planned to do so was an enormous, larger than they had intended to make, Flower of Life of the same design appeared that particular night. There are others, much more extraordinary, much more bizarre, where we've now traced both ends of a cascading sequence of thoughts and events, starting with actually 11 women who had planned to do a meditation night. They hadn't chosen the place or what they would meditate on, but they finished up in a field close to Stonehenge in central southern England. This is in detail in the book with others. And they meditated, strangely, all agreeing on a particular pattern that came to them independently during that sequence, and requested it in their meditation. Some people will call it prayer, but I'll just stick with meditation for now. It doesn't matter. It's a thought process and a transmission. That design, and in the very field where they were stood, the design appeared, and it appeared and was manufactured by a young man, Matthew Williams is his name, who was watching television, just a normal evening, and suddenly got an urge and a design in his head, which he felt he could manufacture. He went out, followed his nose in his motor car, finished up in the very field where the women were transmitting through that process for the very design that he then basically accommodated in that complete process. There's not a lot of difference between, in my view, and the work that we've done here, as you know, executed by people like Dr. Stephen Greer and others, many others, who have vectored in position by another mind process, a UFO in the sky, flashing lights at that UFO, at that single light source in the sky, and it then reacting to them, and I've been present myself to see this, as of many of your listeners, I'm sure. One flash, two flash, three flashes, and on, and the light in the sky is responding to it. So there's very little difference, but what it is interaction and the engagement of a higher part of our minds. And I think that really goes a long way with where the book takes you.
So let me see. This is interesting, because if I'm hearing you correctly, wanting to put words in your mouth, but this is fascinating. Are you suggesting then that the crop circle phenomena, the UFO phenomena, may not be extraterrestrial in nature? It may simply be a reflection or a product of our own minds.
Or that is correct. I'm suggesting that it might be that, or an engagement of our mind by that as one source. In other words, it could well be that this is a program run on Earth by humans, some kind of mind control function. It is perfectly possible. We don't go because we were unable to go as far as to what is the source. What is the source of this intelligence? That's the only criticism I've heard, and I only had that one from one person with the book, was that we don't nail the source. Well, if we were able to do so, we would have done so. I certainly don't feel in any position to be able to say, this is God, you know, this is extraterrestrial. This is our own minds. What we can say is what we have said, and that our minds are positively part of this process, but it isn't all to do with us. you know, one questions what consciousness itself is, and we say there really isn't an adequate definition when it's talking about our mind and how it works. Consciousness is the act of awareness, the substance of form, and the force through which we experience life. It is personal and it is collective. It directs us. It's carried on energy, and yet it isn't energy. It's something beyond. And so when we extend our awareness and intent to use that force of our consciousness, we can manifest and change our surroundings. I think.
All right. Jump in here, Colin. I'm sorry. Sure. We'll take a timeout, come back, and continue to talk about all of these things that are on the edge of reality. Colin and Cynthia Andrews, stay with us. Colin Andrews and Cynthia Andrews, stay with us. On the Edge of Reality, Hidden Technology, Powers of the Mind, Quantum Physics, Paranormal Phenomena, Orbs, UFOs, Harmonic Transmissions, and Crop Circles. And you were talking about what appears to be the connection with our own psychic abilities and the UFO phenomena, the crop circle phenomena. And I couldn't help but notice that you've got another quote on the back of your book from Grant Cameron, of course, a noted Canadian ufologist and a gentleman who's been on this program many times. And on this program, Grant, and also, of course, before the citizen hearing in Washington back in April, Grant was talking about this connection between ESP, telepathy, and the UFO phenomenon. And he told the story of having a conversation with Dr. Eric Walker, who was the former president of Penn State University, no less, and was involved, I believe he was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, and so I had great connections with a lot of military brass. He was friends with Vannevar Bush. And so Cameron was talking to him about UFOs and also Walker's alleged connection with this MJ-12 group. Majestic 12, and he asked Walker, Cameron did, you know, what can you tell me about MJ-12? And did you have contact with aliens? And how do these flying saucers operate? And Walker told him, or asked him, how good is your sixth sense? How much do you know about ESP? And he said, unless you know about it and how to use it, you will not be taken in, referring to Majestic 12.
That's it. Yeah, that's a very, very powerful quote from Grant. That kind of says it all, and I very strongly agree with that statement. A sixth sense, the maturing development to a much more spiritual entity, which is clearly what we have to evolve to be, is what's at stake. I think that's there. It's in the offing. It's on the horizon. But we're far from there. We are far from there. I think if I may just kind of mention an experience that Cynthia and I had, which kind of really, well, it blew me away. That's for sure. I'm the engineer that's kind of struggled with a lot of this up until about 20 years ago, you know, always looking for the yes, no, black, white, you know, very straightforward problems, because, of course, engineers resolve problems. This has been very different. This whole research route has been very different for me and at times difficult. You know, when you have an experience, many others were telling me of their experiences, and then I began to have them myself once I got involved with this in 83. It's bizarre stuff. And, you know, I had left my first marriage disintegrated as much as a result of this work as anything. You know, I left my country in England and came to America back in the early 90s. And Cynthia and I met and obviously eventually married, and we were together asleep. Neither of us had a home at that time. You know, we were both in our second marriages, and we were asleep in her mum's house, and fast asleep, middle of the night, we both woke instantaneously. An event took place with me first. I couldn't move, and it was just an amazing, I can only term it as a download of very pure, very accurate, detailed information related to patterns appearing, the crop patterns appearing in order in very fast movie in front of my eyes across the landscape around Stonehenge in southern England. And these formed an equilateral triangle. It gave me the placement of Stonehenge with regard to that and how important that geometry was for the future. And just as if something turned down that connection that I was having with something, I felt it changing, and I began to move again. I could move. I looked across at Cynthia, wanting to talk to her, basically wake her and tell her about this. Her eyes are open, and maybe I should just leave her to tell you what happened from her perspective.
Yes, Cynthia, take it away.
Well, we actually woke up simultaneously, and I could see, you know, energetically, I could see him expanding. It was like he just became larger than life, and I'm lying there kind of feeling the energy coming from him. And then it deflated. And when he deflated, I expanded. And in the expansion that I had with and this interaction with a light, and I can only say that it was a light that was alive. It wasn't the way that we look at light. It was living light. I received the same information he had received about designs in the landscape, I received about geometries in the body, starting with a triangular geometry between the palms of the hand and the third eye and the forehead, and that when you, that using this geometry in different ways, you activated different parts of your awareness and your perceptions. And so it was a fascinating thing that both of us received the exact same information, him for the landscape and me for the body.
All right, there's that music coming up again, so we'll step away for a moment, come back, and continue to talk about high strangeness. I do want to get to the Norwegian spiral anomaly back in, I guess it was 2009, and how that might all figure into this. And time permitting, I want to talk about orbs as well, because this is something that has started to sort of gnaw at my consciousness. I'm starting to find more and more orbs showing up in my photographs, floating around my head, and different loved ones. Find out what that might mean as well. Back with more of my conversation with Colin and Cynthia Andrews on the edge of reality. Colin and Cynthia Andrews with us, investigators of the high strange and paranormal phenomena. We're talking about, just hidden technology, powers of the mind, orbs, UFOs. I want to talk about the Norwegian spiral back in 2009, appeared in the night sky over Norway, and was photographed from northern Norway and Sweden, and had this blue beam of light, grayish spiral emanating from one end of it. And I'm just wondering, what do you think the significance of that was, the Norwegian spiral?
Well, this is another one, regrettably, where one has to say one doesn't know what it actually was. The Russians, as I think you'll know, the Russian military did claim that it was a rocket that they had lost control of, basically effectively disintegrated as it rose up into the atmosphere. I have a very good friend in the space industry, a NASA contractor, a PhD in this business, and he was one of those who certainly easily convinced me that there was much more to it than that, and that in fact it could not have been the rocket as explained by the Russians, because the spiral itself was a very even, symmetrical spiral. As the object rose into the atmosphere, if that had been a rocket rising up through the atmosphere into thinner layers of the atmosphere, the actual thickness width of each of the spiral rotations would have widened, enlarged, non-symmetrical, is what you would have, and one has seen on many other catastrophic launchings in this country and in other countries. What I think put the feather in the cap for me was shortly after I had this, or was having this discussion with the scientists concerned, when another one showed up in China, and a further one in England, and another on the west coast, I beg your pardon, east coast of Australia. And so we don't know what they were. We felt there was some debate between us on this, whether the new technologies should be inserted in the book. But, you know, when we have secret technology challenging, obviously challenging a challenged system, an Earth system, one, I think, can anticipate other new phenomena to appear. This may well have been one of those new phenomena. There are others we refer to in the book. One of the most bizarre, which we still continue to get reports of, as weird as it sounds, as are black plastic bags. That's exactly what they look like until they morph into orbs, into oblongs, to circles, and they change in size. They react. They have manner and behavior. The one that Cynthia and I saw ourselves was interaction with some crows, some black rooks. I'm not sure what you would call them in Canada.
We call them crows, yes. Crows or yeah. Ravens.
That's right, yeah. Well, we were watching this whole thing unfolding, and no more than a couple of hundred feet away from us. And the birds were dive-bombing this object until it shrunk in size and shot off up into the sky. So, you know, these high strangeness events are escalating. They are, you know, completely outside of the conventional books that many of us have studied over the years. So I don't know what the spiral, the Norway spiral was, but there were four others very much like it.
You hinted that it may be some sort of hidden technology. Are we talking about some sort of a harp type a situation?
Yes, I think that is quite possible. You know, I'm continuing to be researching the chemtrail phenomena that's going on. We did include that also in the book because we were able to prove that they exist and that they are real. You know, a number of individuals have broken ranks, whistleblowers within the programs concerned. The Australian situation is one where, you know, unusual clouds continue to be seen. They have now for 4 years. The radar patterns, which I first got involved in myself in the study of this 3 years ago, I was able to find the correlation with the patterns that appear on their national radar across Australia and relate those particular patterns within days to extreme changes in weather conditions. It, of course, denied by the Australian government to be anything they were aware of and not involved in. And indeed, they even explained the radar themselves in very conventional terms. If you look at their website now, this is the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia, acknowledging there is still to this day an unknown interference, is what they're calling these patterns. There is an acknowledgement from Queensland government that they are involved in weather modification programs. And so, you know, these things are part and parcel of our changing environment, some good and some not so good.
Well, whenever you have, several years ago, there were a bunch of scientists who gathered down, I think it was in San Diego, and they talked about, you know, the need at some point in the future, they call it geoengineering, the need in the future to dump, I don't know, millions of tons of aluminum particulates into the atmosphere to forestall whatever. So my feeling is that whenever scientists gather and tell you we need to do this in the future, that's them basically tipping their hat saying, we're doing it now, but we're telling you we're going to do it in the future.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And I don't think there's any question that that level of particulates in the atmosphere and, of course, eventually on the ground is not doing the health of many, many people any good whatsoever. But their program they would seem to be involved in is to increase reflectivity of harmful penetration of rays from the sun, ultraviolet and so on, into our atmosphere, and to try and attempt to reverse global warming would seem to be what they are about.
And damn the collateral damage.
That's absolutely right, Richard.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. There's two things going on here. One, we're talking about this global consciousness, an expansion in global consciousness, an evolution, if you will, in global consciousness, and our perceptions of what we now label as paranormal are intensifying. And then the other thing that's happening is these. I guess the Gnostics called them the archons, or, you know, the rulers of this world, making war on us. You know, they call it a war on terrorism, but the enemy is really, it seems to be us, you know, the useless eaters, as Kissinger is said to have called us. I'm wondering, are the two things related?
You know, it's a hard one. It's very much a hard one. What I find is that I'm interested in all of those fields. I get angry with them. It makes at times I find it difficult to deal with the internal emotion that peps up inside of me. You know, the disrespect the politicians and some of these multinationals have for us, the eaters, as you were saying, is very difficult to deal with. But because there is such an overwhelming number of problems on our planet, I don't think we can each individually take on the battle of each of them. You know, I felt some years ago that, you know, you choose your battles and step forward and go 100% for what it is you believe or what it is you're interested in. And so I've kind of stuck with the sciences, but I'm very prepared to think well outside the box, as you can see in the book. One has had to do so. And eventually, what you see as being real and important, beyond these creatures that run a lot of these organizations that we're referring to here, you know, there's something much more powerful. These people are individuals. Some are faceless. They are numbers on a door in the Pentagon and so on. You know, these are as frail as anybody else when it comes down to our climate, when it comes down to the higher mind, when it comes down to whose program ultimately is at work. So I think there's just too much to take on board as an individual right across the whole gambit of, you know, human activity.
Right. I'm just wondering, I guess, let me throw this out to Cynthia, and we're just in the final moments here, but I guess what I'm getting at is these, who's ever in charge, you know, if you want to call them the unelected oligarchs or what have you, pick your term, they fear they are losing control. We are voting with our feet. We are walking away from many of the old institutions. They are crumbling around us. And part of the reason, as you both have pointed out, that we are sort of walking away is because of this evolution in our consciousness, and that we are realizing that the reality is not what's being spoon-fed to us like so much pablum by the mainstream media. There's something else going on backstage. We're starting to wake up to that. And these, I use the term archons, are scared to death that they're losing control.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that it goes right back to what you had said earlier about Grant Cameron and the idea that our psychic abilities, and when we really activate who we are as individuals, when we connect with each other and activate our intent, we are more powerful than they really than they can come to terms with. And when we walk away from the systems and we create something in its place that doesn't come from the same foundation, I think it's very scary. And I think that's why all the hidden technologies exist, to try and control populations, to try and control our minds. I think mind control is the biggest thing, that is in development right now. One of the chapters in the book that we put in is what the military is doing with mind control right now, and it is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling.
It is. It's beyond most of our capacity to comprehend. And you know, we're almost out of time here, but when I kicked off the show talking about, for example, this horrible shooting at the Washington Navy Yard and all the similarities that you see with that and many of the other mass shootings, and And one can't help but wonder whether, you know, this mind control program, you know, plays a part in these things. But mm-hmm. one almost hesitates to bring it up, certainly in, you know, in, yeah. In certain company.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a very worrying, it's one of the most worrying aspects to this work. You know, I don't think we've probably time to go into, you know, how the motor and mirror neurons work in our minds, in our brains, and how powerful we are as human beings. You know, the remote viewing, for example, which is a fairly large section in the book, you know, it's a very, very powerful tool, and we're all able to do it. With training, it's an extraordinary skill, but misused and abused. And unfortunately, it always seems to finish up that way when it comes to military application. So, yes, I'm with you absolutely, Richard. It's a worrying side to this.
Well, Colin and Cynthia, I really appreciate your time tonight. Congratulations on the edge of reality. I appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, Richard.
Pleasure talking.
Likewise.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, the website, your portal to The Conspiracy Show is www.richardserrett.com, SYRETT.com. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett, and as always, follow the truth. Hey, friends, welcome aboard. Good to have you with us. Just before I left for Greece, I think, this past summer, my technical producer, Tim Spreen, was telling me about this movie that he had seen, this documentary called Room 237. And Tim, I hadn't seen it, hadn't heard of it. And he said, yeah, it's all about the hidden messages in the movies of Stanley Kubrick, in particular, of course, The Shining, which was a 1980 movie that came out, an adaptation of Stephen King's movie. You remember Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, this couple are basically snowed in at this in this hotel. It actually exists. It's in Colorado. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who joins us from time to time, regularly on the program, has spent a great deal of time there investigating. It's a very famous hotel, haunted. And anyway, it's a horrific situation that happens to this family. Jack Nicholson, of course, goes absolutely bonkers. But many people have different theories as to what Kubrick was trying to tell us in that film. And not only that, in others. And I have talked to another filmmaker, Jay Widener, I believe, who has explored this theme, the hidden messages in the films of Stanley Kubrick. And Kubrick was a very, very interesting cat, to say the least. Didn't do a lot of interviews, maybe one, I think, with the media in his entire career, which has sort of led to, you know, a lot of speculation as to who is he working for and, you know, did he really... was he the man responsible for faking the lunar landing, the moon landing, Apollo 11, filming it on a soundstage and so forth? So there's this whole mystique surrounding Stanley Kubrick and his films. And so then I watched Room 237, and it's a magnificent film. And if you haven't seen it, I really encourage you to do so. So I thought, well, we've got to get this filmmaker on and talk about it, because we've talked about, you know, the faked lunar landings, and we've talked about some of the other things, you know, Kubrick and Eyes Wide Shut. Was he sort of the Illuminati's designated filmmaker, and was he trying to, you know, tell us that this is what's going on in the world with that film, his final film, before he died? So, a great pleasure, having said all that, to welcome Rodney Asher, the director, editor of the film Room 237. As I say, a documentary exploring the signs, symbols, meanings, metaphors, and it includes five very different people who have sort of discovered within Kubrick's The Shining all these different meanings. Rodney Asher is the winner of the 2012 Fantastic Fest Award for Best Director Documentary and the 2012 IDA Creative Achievement Award for Best Editing. Working with producer Vernon Chatman, he edited Andy Kaufman's first comedy album, Andy and His Grandmother. A previous work includes numerous independent shorts, including the infamous The S from Hell, as well as TV commercials, internet quickies, and music videos. Rodney Asher, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations again on Room 237. I really enjoyed it. Interesting sort of subtitle for Room 237 is Many Ways In, No Way Out. Can you explain sort of the subtitle for those people who haven't seen the movie?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the central metaphors, you know, of The Shining is the labyrinth. And one of the sort of exciting things in researching this project, you know, my partner, producer Tim Kirk, was, you know, we started finding so much research that people were doing into, you know, the secrets of The Shining. And, you know, we were very excited to explore them, but we took a step back at one point and said, are we sure we want to do this about The Shining? Is there maybe another film that's generated more of this stuff? And as we looked around, you know, we looked at 2001 as Odyssey, we looked at Eyes Wide Shut, we looked at Mulholland Drive, you know, a handful of other films. Nothing, you know, sort of has generated nearly as much, you know, speculation and inquiry as The Shining did. So we were, you know, very excited to stay on course and to stay with The Shining, you know, and, you know, one of 100 reasons, you know, that seemed to confirm that choice was that in some ways, you know, Room 237 and The Shining are very similar films in that, you know, they're stories of people lost in a maze.
Now, we should explain the name of the film, Room 237 in the hotel, and how that sort of, you know, what is the connection between that room and the supposed fake lunar set that Kubrick supposedly created?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's all, you know, Jay Widener's, you know, theory, and he's made two DVDs. I think he's working on a third now, you know, just exploring Kubrick in himself, and he's written a lot about it online. You know, the shortest version, if we're just if we're only talking about the number itself, is that I guess in the late 70s when they were putting together The Shining, the textbook figure for the distance between the Earth and the moon is 237,000 miles. And, you know, one of the main questions when people look at things that have changed from, you know, The Shining the book to Shining the movie is, you know, the name of that is the number of the room where, you know, all the worst in the hotel happens, you know, kind of the black heart of the hotel. And in the book, the number was 217, and he changed it to 237. So, you know, there's long been a story that, you know, the owners of, I guess this would have been the Timberline Lodge, which is the hotel that they shoot an exterior of, that represents the overlook in a handful of the shots, wanted them to change the number because they had a 217 and they were afraid that, you know, guests would get a little freaked out by staying in such an infamous room. Jay says that's not, in fact, not the case, but whether or not it is, you know, there's a limitless number of alternate room numbers they could have given it. So, you know, it makes you think about the significance of the number 237. I know I look at it, and it seems like sort of perfectly wrong number, like whether it's a prime number or a Fibonacci number, that it's like unbalanced in a way that makes it feel very wrong. And one of the reasons, you know, we called this film Room 237 is there's so many mysteries about concerning that room in the movie, not the least of which, and this isn't something that I think gets talked a lot about when people are discussing the movie, but sort of the central event in the film is when Danny goes into the room, and he comes back out, you know, with his sweater torn and he's sucking his thumb and he's obviously been through something traumatic. Well, we never see or even hear described, at least not from Danny's mouth, what happened in that room, which is so unlike, you know, conventional filmmaking. You know, they may make it a mystery, but they would reveal it at the end. But Kubrick never reveals it. You know, just like, you know, the black and white photo at the end. You know, in some ways, it seems like it's being presented, you know, as if it's, you know, the Rosebud moment from Citizen Kane, you know, kind of a skeleton key that will, you know, help you decode the rest of the movie. But that photograph and that date at the end, you know, July 4th, 1927, does nothing of the kind. You know, it launches you into a new mystery.
And you mentioned Danny, and of course he's wearing this Apollo sweater.
Yeah.
And then there's the room key itself, you know, that says room in big capital letters, R-O-O-M, and no, room number 237. And as Widener has pointed out, you know, there's you can only come up with two words that have those letters in them, and that's moon and room. So the key on the tag, it says moon room.
Yeah, well, he's noticed so many amazing details in the movie. But I'd also go on to say that ghosts don't necessarily need room keys.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, what is it about a Kubrick? I mean, well, let's talk about The Shining. I mean, it's probably the most famous horror film ever made, when arguably. I mean, it's studied at universities. Many books have been written about it. I mean, there's academic analysis that goes on about this film. What is it about The Shining?
Well, I mean, like I said, there's mysteries in it that never get revealed. You know, and I often compare it to the movie The Sixth Sense, which is a good little horror movie. But, you know, I remember, you know the moments of the movie, and, you know, we figure out who's a ghost and who's not and what's been going on, you know, in the entire course of the film. And I left that movie satisfied, and I enjoyed it. I never really thought about it again and was never curious to revisit it. But because Shining leaves so many details unresolved, it nags at you, you know, and you get called back to it thinking that, you know, this is going to be the time, this is going to be the viewing where it's going to finally make sense. And in a way, it's kind of maddening. You can't. You know, I also look at it and compare it to these other films, you know, that are more plainly symbolic than The Shining. You know, plenty of difficult, you know, European art films, you know, Holy Mountain, The Exterminating Angel, you know, plainly symbolic, challenging movies, but none of them are as immediately accessible as The Shining. You know, in some ways, it's kind of the perfect sweet spot, you know, between a mainstream entertainment and a challenging, complicated, ambiguous work of art.
And now, it's more than three decades old, this movie. You know, it came out 1980, I think it was, or 81.
Yeah.
So here we are 30 years later. So why a documentary about sort of the hidden meanings in that movie now?
Well, you know, we found that people are thinking about The Shining more now than ever. You know, Jay Widener is one of them, and four other folks. And except for Bill Blakemore, who, you know, wrote down his thoughts about The Shining in the late 80s, everybody was doing it recently. And that was a question, you know, that we found really interesting. You know, why is this movie some sort of time bomb that took 30 years to go off? But, you know, if you notice, next week, and coincidentally enough, the Room 7 DVD comes out on the same day as Stephen King's sequel to The Shining. You know, so he's been thinking about those characters, too, and finally spurred to action. You know, we don't... You know, 237 as, you know, a symptom of some sort of obsession about The Shining that just seems to be spreading.
We'll take a time out and come back with Rodney Asher, a director editor of Room 237, as we examine the hidden messages in the films of Stanley Kubrick. Stay with us. Rodney Asher is with us, director, editor of the documentary Room 237, which examines some of the countless, conspiracy theories, if you will, some of them outlandish, some of them potentially plausible, in the movie The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's 1980 masterpiece, The Shining. And it's interesting, you know, the collection here of individuals that are featured in the film commenting on this. You mentioned the ABC News correspondent, Bill Blakemore. Tell me a little bit more about Blakemore and how he became involved not only in this project, but you know, an ABC News correspondent who's you know totally immersed himself in sort of the imagery, the metaphors, and the hidden meanings in Kubrick's films, specifically The Shining. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, well, Bill's amazing, and you know, talking with him, you know, I found out that he doesn't really consider himself film buff so much as just a Kubrick buff, you know, and a lot of his tastes, are very classical, very into Shakespeare, and much more than other contemporary filmmakers. But something about Kubrick in general and The Shining in particular just really resonate with him. And you know, he's traveled the world, and he's covered international conflict and wars. So when he started to see, sort of allusions to, cycles of violence and imperialism and even Native American genocide in The Shining, it really struck him. And he's seen sort of similar things in other Kubrick films. In any case, when he heard a little bit about Full Metal Jacket, he decided to take some time and put his thoughts about The Shining down. He wrote an essay that was syndicated in American newspapers in 1987. A lot of it springs off of sort of the Native American imagery within the movie. And, I talked to a lot of people who read his article, in school, in film school or in film appreciation classes. And for a lot of people, for a long time, his reading of the movie was sort of seen as the sort of symbolic take of The Shining, of record.
The Shining is about genocide of the Native Americans.
The Overlook Hotel is on the graveyard of Native Americans, and like a lot of people, see the Overlook Hotel in some ways, as symbolizing America itself. So that hotel was built on a graveyard. You could say the entire nation, was built, on a gigantic graveyard, in the footsteps of people who came before. And he had a really nice way of, I think this was actually it might have been like the mother of a friend of his, but people were talking about The Shining, and he's often bringing it up in conversation, and somebody sort of crystallized what the movie meant to them, which was sins of the past. And like that really resonates with me, thinking about this as a story of unstoppable cycles of violence, and both in the small picture, like the Torrance family and how Jack abused Danny before the movie starts, and then it cycles back on again, but then violence within the hotel, violence within America, violence within the world. And Danny is the one, who kind of sees the way to break the cycle, by researching your past and backing out, sort of symbolically in your in the footsteps. It's like one of the things I love about the way Bill talks about the movie is, not only does he see, sort of these shadows of horror and tragedy within the movie, but he also can kind of read, maybe a hopeful message for how to turn it around.
The clues or the hints in the film that what Kubrick was trying to talk about was Native American genocide. Very subtle. I mean, unless you're really paying attention, and I guess not until the advent maybe of videotape and VHS, where people were able to first sort of stop and examine the film frame by frame, would you be able to see, for example, that sitting on one of the shelves is this big can of Calamay baking powder, this big canister adorned with the image of a Native American sort of in traditional garb. What are some of the other clues, that Blakemore points out that The Shining is about Native American genocide?
Well, these other lines of dialogue, from the management of the hotel, there's a ton of actually Native American decor within the film. you know, both the you know, paintings on the wall, portraits, those gigantic Navajo, I think they're Navajo, I could be wrong, sort of tapestries that Jack is tossing the tennis ball against. And he compares that in a way that I thought was really striking, into sort of Napoleon troops taking target practice, you know, on the Sphinx when they were, you know, when they were in Egypt. You know, that kind of casual, playful, you know, destruction of, you know, this beautiful ancient, you know, artifact. You know, and it's kind of, there's also a throwaway line that really struck me where as Danny and Wendy are leaving the hotel and they're running off to the maze, Wendy says, "Loser has to keep America clean." And for any, for at least an American growing up in the 70s, there was that PSA with a crying Indian, which to this day, you know, is maybe has some nostalgic camp value, but in the day when that came out, you know, and the Native American was sort of canoeing through a garbage river, and he comes up on a into a clearing, and it's this horrible superhighway, and somebody throws a pile of trash at his feet, and he turns to the camera and cries a single tear. Back then, it just reduced all of us into bawling.
It was iconic, absolutely, yes.
And when she says "Loser keeps America clean," she's told. It's totally evocative with that line because it says "keep America clean," you know, and she's calling Native Americans losers. She's also, you know, like at another point in the film, wearing a yellow jacket that has sort of Indian prints on it, and you know, you could say that in some ways she's coded as a Native American for, you know, when Jack turns on her, you know, and is chasing her with the axe, and the axe itself, you know, Bill sees as a symbol of, you know, westward expansion and clearing the forests. Because in the book, again, you know, Jack didn't use an axe. He used a croquet mallet.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, and though Jay Widener is the one who, like, really explicitly, and he had a great way of saying it, it's when you look, looking at details of things that have been changed from the...
Oop, we lost you there. Are you still with us, Rodney? His cell phone cut out. Rodney Asher is on the line from, I believe he's in Los Angeles or certainly in California, and the director and editor of a documentary film that came out last year, received a great many accolades and critical praise, also won a lot of awards. It's called Room 237, and essentially it examines the hidden meanings, messages inside Kubrick's The Shining, which of course was the 1980 or 81 film adaptation of Stephen King's novel. You've probably seen the film a couple of times, and it's one of those films that certainly stays with you, but you may not be aware that this film has probably, well, in one article I was reading, it suggested, you know, that the analysis of The Shining, the academic analysis of The Shining, almost rivals, you know, the Talmud. But it's interesting. If you talk to Kubrick aficionados, they will they'll corner you in a room and talk your ear off about the hidden meanings and messages inside The Shining and what their particular theory is. And we're talking about those with Rodney Asher. We've talked about you know, the Apollo 11 lunar landing and whether this was Kubrick's confession. You know, that he was so conflicted about, you know, staging and filming the lunar landing on a stage, or a sound stage, that he, you know, he was just dying to sort of tip us off to that fact. And that's what The Shining is about. And, of course, others like Bill Blakemore, ABC News correspondent, a Kubrick aficionado, his take on it is that it's about Native American genocide. The other theory, and there are many, we're only going to touch on a few of them here, is that The Shining is really a movie about the Holocaust. Rodney, explain.
Well, this comes from, there's one of the people we speak to is Professor Jeffrey Cox, who specializes in German history, and particularly German World War II history. And there are a couple of things, like, you know, I think like the way that Bill and even Jay Widener come at it is, first, a single detail comes out that reminds you of something and seems kind of strange and out of place. And then the more you look around, you find more details that, you know, kind of sort of confirm that point of view and deepen it and, you know, have more and more allusions to it. And I think the two things that Professor Cox first noticed, one was a typewriter that Jack used, that it was a German brand. It had an eagle on it. Eagle is a symbol of the Third Reich. And he thought about typewriters in general. And there's a book about the Holocaust, the destruction of the European Jews, and sort of the emphasis of that book is what a bureaucratic process it was, you know, that, you know, putting aside the horror of it for a second, think about, you know, just administratively what a complicated, gigantic project it was, and how many, you know, sort of middle managers and typists and clerks had to be involved in coordinating it. You know, so
the banality of evil.
Exactly. You know, so of typewriters, there's a lot of lists, there's a lot of repetition. You know, so there's both Schindler's List, you know, which was, you know, a list for good, but there were, you know, so many more of these horrible lists. And Jeffrey's written a book on the subject called The Wolf at the Door, and then he edited another one, an anthology with other people's writings as well. And the typewriter kind of opened it up for him, and he saw that throughout the film, the number 42 kept recurring. And the number 42, among other things, in 1942 was the year where, I forget the name, there was a council, you know, where the Nazis moved forward with the final solution. And with those two things that sort of put him on that track, you know, he started looking at the film closer and closer and closer. There's the moment when Jack says, little pigs, let me in, not by the hair of your chinny chin chin. And he's channeling the big bad wolf. Well, there's a 1930s version of the Three Little Pigs that Disney produced. And, you know, back then, you know, Disney, I guess they had a reputation for, you know, anti-Semitic imagery in their films. And gosh, if you look at the character that the Big Bad Wolf disguised himself as, you know, it looks like a Yiddish, you know, door-to-door gentleman and kind of a mean caricature of one. And that's the version, you know, that Kubrick would have seen when he was a little kid, you know, in New York. So these kind of details, you know, accumulate, you know,
right,
as you watch the film. And
right.
And his thoughts dovetail really nicely with Jeffrey's. I mean, in some ways, with Bill's, and in some ways, although we're talking about, you know, a different time and a different place, it's sort of the same subject.
We were both sort of struggling to figure. It was the WANSI conference in 1942 where the final solution was decided on. The other thing you mentioned again, the typewriter, and of course, you know, what is Jack supposedly working on, you know, the great American novel, and what is he typing over and over and over again? All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, which I guess what symbolizes again this mechanical, methodical process by which, you know, the Jews were exterminated in such a cold and soulless and heartless manner.
Yeah, well, when you look at the way that Wendy reacts when she sees that paper, it's kind of played as the most horrifying moment in the film.
Yes, yes. What do we ascribe this to? I mean, let's crawl inside Kubrick's mind, if that's even possible. I mean, this guy was said to have an IQ somewhere around 200. You know, absolutely, you know, brilliant. I mean, that doesn't even do the justice to describe his intelligence. And yet, you know, you see in The Shining, a lot of things which appear to be continuity issues, you know, where they'll take a shot and in the frame you'll see something, and then when you go back to that shot, it's not there anymore. So which is sort of fed into this whole, you know, into this the mystique and the legend. Were they continuity errors, or was Kubrick, because of his, you know, incredible intellect, was he using those as symbols? Well, what do you make of that? Tell us. Tell us what you think of what was going on inside Kubrick's mind.
Well, I mean, if we're going to talk about the continuity errors, and certainly it may be that some of them are errors, but there's an awful lot of them. You know, and he's somebody with a reputation for being incredibly methodical, for doing 1,000 takes. And, you know, I've seen reproductions of continuity photos that were taken on set, you know, those little Polaroids they take to make sure that, you know, the pens on the desk were in the right place, you know, from shot to shot to shot. You know, so it wasn't a workplace. I was teaching an editing class while I was working on the film, and one thing I liked to do was, you know, we spent, you know, in the first part of the, you know, of the year talking about the rules of filmmaking, you know, the conventions that they needed to maintain, you know, for the film to look professional. But then I started screening scenes from movies that would break these rules, you know, things like Soderbergh's The Limey, you know, or William Friedkin's To Live and Die in L.A. And, you know, when you know that the filmmaker is a professional and is experienced and, in fact, you know, is a master, and you see that every technical quality, you know, is at the highest level, from the, you know, camera work to the lighting to the design, when you see things that seem like errors, they're at least worth considering as being intentional.
All right, listen, we'll take a time out, Rodney, come back, and maybe we can talk a couple of those seemingly continuity errors, and in fact may in fact be little hints or hidden messages contained in Stanley Kubrick's movies like The Shining. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. We're examining hidden messages inside Stanley Kubrick's 1981 masterwork, The Shining. And Rodney Asher is with us, the director, editor of the critically acclaimed documentary Room 237, which features five sort of theories as to what Kubrick was trying to tell us in the movie The Shining. And these range from, Kubrick's confession that he had faked the lunar landing, the Apollo 11 lunar landing, had filmed it on a soundstage somewhere, I guess, in the Nevada desert or where have you. Others contend that it is, in fact, a movie about genocide of the American natives. And still others contend that it is a movie about the Holocaust. Now, we're talking about some of the little, the strange, some call them continuity errors. But if you really pay attention to the film, and again, I mentioned, you know, the advent of videotape, VHS rather, and where people were able to actually, you know, examine the film frame by frame. One of the interesting things I found was Stuart Ullman, the character Stuart Ullman, who is the hotel manager, and he's sort of interviewing Jack Nicholson's character at the beginning of the film. Nicholson is supposed to be, he and his family are sort of caretakers while the hotel shuts down for the season and through the winter months. And if you look at it sort of frame by frame, Stuart Ullman is making these very bizarre hand gestures. He's not just, you know, folding his hands as he's seated at the desk. He's making very peculiar hand gestures. What do you make of those, Stuart? Sorry, Rodney. What do you make of Stuart Ullman's hand gestures?
Well, you know, I think those aren't called out within the film. Is this something you've noticed, or is that
I had made a few notes when I'd watched The Shining again, and I just wondered if you had noticed that, or if any of your any of the people that you'd commented. Yeah, I know it's not in your documentary, but
yeah, I'm excited because this is a new one to me. None of the folks that we talked to brought this up, and I don't think I've come across it. Reading about The Shining.
Yeah, well, if you go back to that scene where Ullman is seated at the desk, he's making some very unnatural hand gestures. I made a note of that, and I just wanted to get your take. I didn't know if you had ever discussed that. I know it's not in your documentary, but some of the other interesting sort of, I don't know, some call them gaffes, some call them continuity issues. What can you tell us about some of those and the significance,
maybe? Well, there's a really good one that I had never noticed that Jeffrey Cox called out, where when Danny at the beginning of the film is talking to Tony, that there's that we're looking at him through past the wall, past the door to his room, and there's all these stickers on the door, and one of them is Dopey from the Seven Dwarfs.
Right.
So he's looking in the mirror and he's talking to Tony, and he gets this vision of blood and horror, and then when he wakes up inside in his room and he's being consoled by his mom and his doctor, if you look at the wall behind him, that sticker is gone. And Jeffrey says, because at this point he has seen the vision of what's happening and what has happened, and he's no longer a dope. You know, that he's lost a layer of naivete, and that's signaled by, you know, Dopey disappearing.
Is there any particular theory that you give more credence to as to what Kubrick was trying to tell us in The Shining? Is there one that you think is more plausible than the other?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to do because, you know, getting into this, my assumption was going to be that, you know, five different people, five different points of view, that they couldn't all be right, and that there must be at least an idea or two that I could dismiss. Not necessarily as not interesting or not significant, but is probably not Kubrick's intent. But, you know, the more you drill down, in a way it's like, you know, impressionist art, but it kind of dissolves in your hands, that I could always find a yes but no but maybe kind of justification for any one particular detail that they brought up. I know, like when I was a kid, you know, maybe I was 10 years old when I figured out that the Giving Tree, you know, is actually about, you know, the sacrifices that a mother goes through for her child, and that, you know, that story and, you know, all the kids' stories I had read were working on two levels. You know, I see no reason to think that The Shining, you know, can't be working on five or more.
All right, we'll take another time out. This was a short break. Come back and a few moments remain with Rodney Asher. Oh, just before we go into break, remind us, the DVD release and Blu-ray release of Room 237 is when, Rodney?
September 24th.
September 24th, just around the corner.
Just around the corner.
All right, back with more of my conversation with Rodney and our discussion on Room 237, the hidden meanings inside Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Rodney Asher stays with us as we discuss his documentary film, Room 237, which is an examination of the various theories regarding the hidden messages that may or may not be contained in Stanley Kubrick's horror film, perhaps the most celebrated horror film of all time, The Shining. And what has been the feedback from Stanley Kubrick's camp? I mean, Stanley Kubrick, of course, passed away, but, you know, people that worked maybe on the film or people that worked closely with Kubrick, what do they make of the film, of Room 237?
Well, I've only talked to one of them in person, you know, who's Leon Vitali, who was, you know, Kubrick's assistant, and he played, you know, Lord Bullinden in Barry Lyndon, an amazing actor, and, you know, a guy I was really excited to meet. And he was initially kind of dismissive of a lot of these ideas. We actually had a great roundtable debate. Him, me, and Jay White were on the same panel with Mick Garris, who directed the TV movie version. And, you know, it was a pretty lively debate, and it was funny because, you know, he would say things like, you know, the Calumet can wasn't picked because of the Native American imagery, but for the color, which to me still seemed significant that 30 years on, he remembered, you know, this prop, which was, you know, kind of an incidental, you know, set dressing, is being picked very specifically, you know, for the scene. And even the color red that it is a color that people have talked about, you know, very specifically, you know, as having meaning, you know, throughout his films. You know, and his producer, Jan Harlan, it was interesting, he was, I've never spoken with him personally, and you know, he was dismissive of some details, but he confirmed others. You know, things about the impossible, almost M.C. Escher-esque landscape within the hotel, and, you know, I'm totally respect, you know, his opinion. If the idea of, you know, 237 is that different people see The Shining differently, you know, he's going to see it, you know, more differently, much, much, much differently than us. But even people who are there can't necessarily speak for, you know, what was for choices he made, you know, that were that he didn't necessarily talk about. You know, people don't always explain every decision they make to everyone that they work with. And there's also, you know, so much to say about, you know, subconscious choices. You know, you pick this actor instead of that one, this costume instead of this, that prop, and they all and they all add up to one thing, to one thing or another.
What do you make of the theory that the Shining is a film that's meant to be seen both forwards and backwards? In fact, if you were to project it simultaneously, with one version being played the normal way and the other being superimposed and run backwards from end to beginning, the sort of the resulting images are quite interesting. You know, where certain scenes overlay on others, and it seems to be you're able to appreciate it at a whole different meaning or a whole different level.
Yeah, no, that is uncanny that this guy John Phil Ryan was inspired to do it reading something else that this guy the Mastermind had written about it. And the idea, very loosely, was when you look at the structure of the film, in some ways, it's an inversion of 2001: A Space Odyssey. You know, and people have talked about how if 2001 is about the evolution of mankind, The Shining is a de-evolution, a descent into savagery. And if you just very quickly think about the structure of the film, the beginning of the movie is a tour of these locations that we revisit again later. So for a bunch of reasons, you know, the idea was that maybe scenes at the beginning are meant to be seen like very much in juxtaposition with scenes from the end. And, you know, certainly, you know, Kubrick is a symmetrical filmmaker. You know, the left and the right of the frame are often very balanced. You know, or you think of a movie like Full Metal Jacket, which is in these two distinct pieces, you know, that kind of echo each other. So they set up this screening where they projected it forwards and backwards, simultaneously superimposed, and the way things lined up just gave everybody the willies. And we do a short, you know, tour through some of the highlights in 237, but I've seen the entire thing projected, you know, with an audience, and their jaw just hits the floor as things happen, like Lloyd the bartender says, you know, women, you can't live with them and you can't live without them. And floating over the frame is the young woman and the old hag from room 237. I mean, that kind of thing just happens again and again and again as you watch the film.
It reminds me of when someone first brought to my attention that if you sync up the Pink Floyd album Dark Side of the Moon and you cue it so that it begins where the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Lion in the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. And are you familiar with that? The synchronicities between...
I thought a lot about that too, and I don't know if it's totally related, but, you know, when I think about that experiment, you know, assuming that it wasn't intentional from the band, and that seems to be, you know, what's most likely based on interviews with them, I think it says something just wonderful about, you know, the way storytelling has evolved, long-form storytelling over thousands of years, that, you know, sort of these patterns recur, you know, whether you're writing a long rock album or making a movie that, you know, 5 minutes in, you know, things start to get serious, 15 minutes in, maybe there's a reversal of some sort, and that kind of pattern recurs in these different works, you know, and you put them together, and it's kind of, you know, eerie and uncanny to see the relationships.
Or perhaps it says more about our need as humans to find these patterns, you know, it's nothing more than that. It's not coming necessarily from the artist, it's coming from the audience.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't dismiss that as something, you know, unsignificant or uninteresting either.
Absolutely not, no. Well, Kubrick was... was very recalcitrant. He didn't like to talk to the media very much. I mean, I guess he would speak when he had to, when a film of his was being released. And I guess that he seems to have been a very sort of secretive person. Maybe that's not necessarily true, but that's sort of the image that we're left with because of, you know, his, I guess, his unwillingness to speak to the media. Has that also been responsible for sort of playing into this mystique and the legend surrounding, you know, the messages that may or may not be in his films?
I think so. I mean, well, on the one hand, I think he was, you know, smart not to talk too much about the themes and the symbols within his film, to allow the audience to engage with it and to wonder, you know, to answer the questions themselves. You know, there's a quote, you know, where he said something along the lines of, you know, the Mona Lisa wouldn't be improved if there was a little plaque underneath saying, you know, she's smiling this way, thinking about, you know, what her lover would have looked like when he was a little boy, because, you know, then there'd be no reason to wonder. Though what's interesting, I guess, you know, if you parse that, is that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't about something in specific, even if he's allowing you to look at it how you will.
I know this wasn't the subject matter of your film, Room 237, but his last film, Eyes Wide Shut, you know, and people talk about the occult symbolism in that movie, and Jay Widener, you know, and he's been on my show. We've talked about the theory that Kubrick was sort of the Illuminati's designated filmmaker, and this, in large measure, was why he was so secretive and didn't want to talk, or wasn't permitted, perhaps, to talk. Did you and Jay have those sorts of conversations during the making of the movie?
A little bit, yeah, I think, and we've got a little. We have a very small discussion of that as a deleted scene within 237. But those themes are much more present in in Eyes Wide Shut. And I think if you're going to say that, you know, kind of that kind of stuff might be the equivalent of, in Eyes Wide Shut, as sort of the moon landing sequence within Room 237. I know I was excited. It was late to get into 237, but, you know, I discovered that there were folks who looked at that. There's a scene in 237 where there's a woman who sees a lot of Minotaur imagery within The Shining, and she talks about the poster here that looks sort of like a Minotaur, and the word over it is monarch, and she sees that, you know, as an allusion to, you know, sort of the decadent ruling class, the kings, I think Stuart Ullman says royalty estate at the hotel, and there's that. But when you get into, you know, some of the ways that people have been talking about Eyes Wide Shut, with both ideas about the Illuminati or mind control, you know, the monarch program comes up. So I was, you know, very excited to see just within that one poster there are these two radically different, you know, symbolic reads. We're only able to get so much into 237, and there were moments where I tried to suggest that what we're seeing in it was only the tip of the iceberg.
So what's next for you, Rodney? I mean, are you going to pursue other projects that involve symbolism in Kubrick's films?
Not in the short term. I may be trying to do too many things at once. I've got like two or three things that I'm doing at the same time, but none of them are specifically about Stanley Kubrick right now.
This is
my big Stanley Kubrick project, at least for right now.
Sure. What do we know? What Stephen King thought of Kubrick's reworking of his novel?
He wasn't crazy about it.
And why did he say?
Well, I've heard things. You know, I've heard that he didn't think it was scary, that he was disappointed that Kubrick downplayed some of the themes of alcoholism, and he's promoting, you know, his sequel to it now, and he talks about this, the Kubrick film is being cold and unsympathetic to Wendy. And it's interesting because he actually, you know, was so interested in seeing another version of The Shining as a film that in the 90s he produced and wrote, you know, like a six-hour-long miniseries, a version that's totally different that Mick Garris directed. And it's, you know, really interesting to, you know, take a look at them back to back.
Indeed. Well, listen, Rodney, I really appreciate your time. And we should also mention once again that the DVD and Blu-ray release of Room 237 is coming up in just a few days, September the 24th. And people will be able to pick that up, and I really encourage them to do so. It's fascinating. Whether you're a Kubrick fan, whether you just love The Shining, this will give you a whole new insight into the film. Again, Rodney, thank you. Appreciate your time.
Oh, sure. Great to talk to you. Thanks.
Rodney Asher, the director-editor of Room 237. All right. My thanks to Tim Spreen for technical production. Back next week, Don Schmidt, the Roswell investigator, will be along with our good friend Victor Vigiani from Zealand News Network to talk about Roswell Deathbed Confessions. We'll also touch on Don's new book, which talks about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and whether or not that's the real Area 51. And we're working on a few other things. I believe very shortly we'll have Canada's Edgar Casey, Douglas James Cottrell back on the program talking about earth changes, solar storms, the possibility of a financial collapse, and so forth. Hope you'll be along for that. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.